This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hi, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Fortune Program with articles from Fortune and Forbes magazines. Today, from Fortune magazine, Kamalanomics, Harris's Roadmap for Business. Vice President Kamala Harris hasn't done much to woo big business. Many executives would still rather take their chances with her than the alternative. By Jeff Colvin. Kamala Harris's first speech outlining her economic policies did not bode well for business. In Raleigh, North Carolina, a week before the convention where she officially became the Democrats' nominee for president, her language sounded bellicose. She boasted that as California's attorney general, she took on insurance companies and big pharma, that she went after companies that illegally raised prices, and that as president she would attack the high cost of health care and crack down on unscrupulous corporate landlords. In that speech and many to follow, big banks, Wall Street, corporations, and middlemen were the liberal version of red meat, dirty words thrown out to elicit loud boos. Yet while Harris's public rhetoric does little to win over business people, she is attracting the support of many of them. The language in an endorsement letter signed by 90 prominent business figures shows clearly why: her predictability compared with her erratic opponent. The letter oozes with implied disdain of Donald Trump and asserts that electing Harris is the best way to support reliability and stability. The signatories, which included tech founders and media moguls, as well as executives from the banking, investment, insurance, and pharmaceutical industries, offered a bottom-line rationale for Harris in the White House. Quote, "The business community can be confident that it will have a president who wants American industries to thrive." Close quote. Those tycoons can't be thrilled by Harris's robustious promotion of higher taxes for richly paid individuals like themselves. Her lack of private sector employment in her career may worry them. But as one signatory, a high-level Wall Street executive, tells Fortune, "Even those whose tax bills may be increased recognize the impact on the American economy is going to be materially negative in a Trump scenario." For the Harris campaign, being less objectionable than the alternative may be enough to put her over the top in November. But if she is elected and finds herself steering the government's relationship with business, she may find that being the lesser of two evils is not a particularly strong position. Harris praises the Bidenomics of the administration she's now a part of, and has often said that, "By virtually every measure, our economy is the strongest in the world." But CEOs can be a tough audience, and they certainly aren't cheering. In the Conference Board's latest survey, big company CEOs are barely above the line separating optimism from pessimism. Small business owners are even less upbeat. The National Federation of Independent Business reports that optimism is in the dumps. Meanwhile, 63% of Americans say the economy is on the wrong track. Against that backdrop, Harris's first economic promise, exempting tips from taxation, was canny. It copied a Trump promise that appeals to America's 2.3 million waitstaff and also to restaurant owners. Her other early high-profile promise to pursue the first-ever federal ban on price gouging on food backfired. Economists, including economic advisors from the Clinton and Obama administrations, quickly denounced the proposal because price restrictions would likely make shortages worse. Harris has rarely mentioned the price gouging ban in recent weeks. Harris now seems to be gaining her footing on economic policy, but many Americans are still left with a simple, vital question: what would President Kamala Harris do? Kamala Harris on taxes. The most consequential fight over economic policy in 2025 will center on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, TCJA, which expires at year-end. This massive law, enacted under Trump in 2017 with no Democratic votes in the House or Senate, rewrote the tax rules for individuals, small companies, and big companies. At least one key element, the tax reduction for the 97% of American households earning less than $400,000 a year, could be extended with a broad bipartisan support. That would sail through with an enormous supermajority of both parties, says Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute, a right-leaning public policy think tank focused on economic policy. The debate is what to do about those earning over $400,000. Democrats have campaigned heavily on the claim that Trump cut taxes for billionaires, so it's hard to imagine a President Harris signing an extension of the cut, even though many business people earning $400,000 to $700,000 don't feel like plutocrats. Harris has endorsed the Biden proposal to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. That would still be much lower than the 35% rate before the TCJA, but when including state taxes, it would be the second highest corporate tax in the OECD, Riedel says. And because of other changes in tax rules, companies would face a significantly higher overall corporate tax burden than before the 2017 tax cuts. The Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, CRFB, estimates the tax hike would increase federal revenue by $1 trillion over 10 years, but mustering the political will to enact her full corporate tax program could be difficult, even if she has a Democratic Congress. Harris also endorses President Biden's proposed tax on unrealized capital gains for individuals with a net worth of over $100 million, which the CRFB estimates would bring in $500 billion over a decade, and Biden's proposal to hike the tax on corporate stock buybacks from 1 to 4%, which the CRFB estimates would bring in $150 billion over a decade. She breaks with Biden on his proposed 39.6% tax on realized capital gains for households with taxable income over $1 million. Harris favors a 28% rate. The current rate is 20%. Those taxes also would be tough to enact in full. More broadly, Harris has endorsed Biden's budget of the U.S. government, which the president must propose every year. The latest version, 188 pages, would increase taxes by $5 trillion over the next decade, growing slightly faster than predicted GDP. Kamala Harris on regulation. By the calculations of the American Action Forum, a center-right think tank that has tallied the costs of federal regulations for each year since 2005, the Biden administration has set a record. It has imposed $1.7 trillion of regulatory costs on the private sector, says Douglas Holtz Eakin, AAF's founder and a former director of the Congressional Budget Office. By comparison, Obama did $870 billion in two terms. The most vigorous regulator of the past 4 years has been the Federal Trade Commission and its polarizing chair, Lina Khan, who is trying to break up Amazon and wants to block the merger of grocery giants Kroger and Albertsons. At least 19 deals have been abandoned after the FTC filed challenges. This hasn't just frustrated business leaders who support Trump. Major Harris donors, including media executive Barry Diller and LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, want Harris to fire Khan. But whether or not Khan remains in a Harris administration, the FTC would likely continue on a similar track, says Heidi Shierholz, president of the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute. Harris may even widen the FTC's remit. With voters still experiencing sticker shock at the grocery store, Shierholz says, I think one of the ways she will address price increases is through the antitrust route, by blocking the Kroger-Albertsons merger, for example. Kamala Harris on tariffs. During the September Harris-Trump debate, Harris said, My opponent has a plan that I call the Trump sales tax, which would be a 20% tax on everyday goods that you rely on. Few viewers would have guessed she was talking about Trump's proposal to impose a tariff as high as 20% on all U.S. imports. Indeed, tariffs rarely play a role in retail politics until they do. That's what happened when President Trump launched a trade war by imposing tariffs on several major countries, notably China. Harris described this accurately. Tariffs are indeed a tax on the people and businesses of the importing country, in this case the U.S., but she made no mention of the Trump tariffs the Biden administration kept. In fact, the Biden administration has kept nearly all of Trump's tariffs, increasing some and adding more, mostly on Chinese imports. Harris has said little more than this about tariffs. But de-escalating a trade war isn't easy, and she has shown no particular intention to do so. A spokesman for the Harris-Walz campaign has said she will employ targeted and strategic tariffs to support American workers, strengthen our economy, and hold our adversaries accountable. Kamala Harris on housing. Millions of Americans can't afford the home they would like, in large part because so few homes are for sale and scarcity has driven up their prices. That's why Harris has made housing one of her key issues. It's the problem she aims to solve with one of her boldest promises. By the end of my first term, we will end America's housing shortage by building 3 million new homes and rentals that are affordable for the middle class. Like her price-gouging proposal, this one has its skeptics. As well as offering builders a tax break to build starter homes, her plan includes a $25,000 tax break to help first-time home buyers with the down payment on a new home. Economists have quickly noted that the subsidy would increase demand and could push home prices up. In addition, 3 days after she introduced her affordable housing program, the Biden administration nearly doubled tariffs on imported Canadian lumber, pushing up construction costs. Her supporters point out that the incentives for home builders would increase supply, countering the program's stimulus to demand. A nice kind of 1-2 punch, says EPI's Shearholz. But Riedel and others point out that in many localities, the main impediments to low-cost housing are ordinances and zoning codes, which are unlikely to be fixed by federal policy. He worries that we'll get the higher demand without increased supply, which would push home prices upward. Harris's running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, has supported several changes, including revised local building codes and zoning, that have increased housing supply and slowed rent increases in his state. Kamala Harris on the federal debt. This will be the number one issue facing the next president, but it's also the issue no candidate wants to talk about. Profligate overspending is a bipartisan habit. The national debt held by the public was $14.4 trillion at Trump's inauguration and $22 trillion at Biden's inauguration. It's $28 trillion now, and Biden's latest 10-year budget predicts it will reach $45 trillion in 2034. Interest payments have reached $1 trillion a year. That's why the U.S. Government Accountability Office warns that the growing debt is unsustainable. Harris often says her proposed programs would pay for themselves. So does Trump. For example, she said in August that if the government increases the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, as she proposes, the return on that investment in terms of what it will do and what it will pay for will be tremendous. We've already seen it when we did it in the first year of our administration, and it reduced child poverty by over 50%. Those credits do improve lives and have bipartisan support, and they may pay off in long-term economic outcomes. Children may eventually get better jobs than they otherwise would have, for example. But increasing spending on most programs does not pay for itself in any sense the U.S. Treasury would recognize. The looming debt crisis would be a massive problem in a Harris presidency. If she wins 2 terms, she could be the first president to confront debt doomsday. On the current trajectory, Social Security will be unable to pay full benefits starting in 2033, when her second term would end. The political conflagration with Harris at its center would be well underway by then unless both parties mend their ways now, which they show no signs of doing. Harris can't be criticized on this issue more than any other presidential candidate. With all the talk of tax cuts and generous government programs, they all skip over the debt crisis, and voters aren't demanding answers. The nonpartisan Penn Wharton budget model estimates that Harris's policy proposals would increase the primary deficit, which excludes interest payments, by $2 trillion over 10 years. Trump's policy proposals would increase it by $4.1 trillion. A smaller increase is better, but either approach is pushing the country ever closer to a crisis. Next, from Forbes magazine, New Billionaire, From E Street to Easy Street, How Bruce Springsteen Turned His Blue-Collar Music into a Ten-Figure Fortune. In rock and roll, as in business, it's good to be the boss. Over five decades, Bruce Springsteen, New Jersey's original guitar hero, has amassed a substantial fortune, which Forbes conservatively estimates to be worth $1.1 billion, singing about his blue-collar roots. Even now, at 74, he's still touring and doing three-hour shows. Always a workman's workman, Bruce is clocking in and rolling up his sleeves. From his first major label LP, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, 1973, Springsteen's music spun tales of manual labor, finding love, and getting out of the place that rips the bones from your back. He would know, having been born in a Jersey Shore town to working-class parents and living with his paternal grandparents in what he once described as their noticeably decrepit home. After helping put Asbury Park's Stone Pony Club on the map in the 1970s, Springsteen dominated the charts with 21 studio albums, 7 live albums, and 5 EPs, selling more than 140 million records globally. He has also told his stories in a number one New York Times best-selling memoir and 236 sold-out Broadway performances. Along the way, he won 20 Grammys, an Oscar, 2 Golden Globes, and a special Tony Award, and has earned a place in both the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Songwriters Hall of Fame. The man who sang about being born in the USA has also received the country's highest awards, accepting Kennedy Center honors in 2009 and a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2016. In 2021, shortly after his second run of Springsteen on Broadway ended, he sold his music catalog to Sony, earning a lump sum of $500 million for his life's work. At the time, his longtime manager, John Landau, said the deal was deserved for the half-century Springsteen spent making music. "Everybody is getting what is in their interest," Landau told Forbes in 2022. The glory days keep coming. In 2023, Springsteen's world tour sold more than 1.6 million tickets, generating $380 million in revenue per Polestar. With concerts scheduled through mid-2025 and no apparent plans to slow down, the elder statesman of Heartland Rock remains, in his words, a gun for hire. Also from Forbes, Wellness Wunderkinder, getting healthy and perchance wealthy with the Forbes 30 Under 30 in 30 words or less. Mosley Andrews, 29, Rory Beyer, 28, Samir Jaffrey, 28, co-founders Aviva Solutions, Brisbane, California. Kickstart that heart. Backed by $99 million, Aviva builds the smallest, lightest FDA-approved external defibrillator. The device costs $1,650, is rechargeable, and intended for use in offices, stores, and schools. Dina Radenkovich, 28, co-founder Gameto, New York City. IVF requires a lot of painful shots. This baby's backed by $73 million in funding for clinical development of tech to quickly mature eggs outside the body, minimizing hormone injections. Vasu Nadella, 29, co-founder, Vital Biosciences, Toronto. Nadella's machine supposedly can process 53 different blood tests in just 20 minutes. Despite Theranos's gruesome end, Vital has raised some $66 million. Investors include Sam Altman and Mark Benioff. And Aidan Duar, 28, Stephanie Liu, 28, Sam Perkins, 28, co-founders Nourish, New York City. Managing diabetes, cholesterol, blood pressure, even cancer can require significant dietary changes. This telehealth firm with $44 million in funding connects patients with registered dietitians, helping over 100,000 so far. Also, from a column called Billionaires, the world's richest prisoner. Changpeng Zhao, known simply as CZ, reported to Lompoc, the federal pen in Southern California, in May to serve a four-month sentence for failing to police money laundering on his Binance crypto exchange. But being behind bars hasn't hurt his finances. Far from it. CZ is currently worth some $57.8 billion, more than five times as much as before he pleaded guilty last year. What gives? First, Binance, despite CZ's legal woes, is doing great. To settle the government charges, the exchange agreed to pay a $4.3 billion penalty. CZ personally agreed to pay an additional $150 million. But over the last 6 months, Binance has held on to its 42% global market share. Forbes estimates CZ owns 90% of the business. Second, a lot of CZ's wealth is in Binance's exchange-issued tokens, called BNB, which are a bit like airline loyalty points, except they trade publicly. BNB is up 70% year-to-date, trading as high as $725 each, and a recent Forbes investigation with Grey Wolf Analytics reveals CZ likely has 94 million of them. That should go a long way at the Lompoc commissary, where a pair of fresh socks recently cost $1.60 and a snack bag of chili cheese Fritos went for $2.70. Next from Forbes, a handful of short pieces under the heading New and Notable. Ramp. CEO Eric Glyman, valuation $7.7 billion, corporate cards and expenses. After Glyman sold his first company, online flight price tracker Parabus, to Capital One in 2016, he shifted his focus to fintech, co-founding Ramp 3 years later. The New York City-based startup provides digital credit cards with custom limits and banking features to tech outfits including Shopify, Discord, and Glossier. Ramp helps corporate card users spend less, saving money for their companies. It's great to get a dollar back for every $100 you spend, Glyman says, but the best way to get more in your bank account is not spending that $100. CoreWeave, CEO Mike Intrator, valuation $19 billion, cloud-based compute. CoreWeave CEO Mike Intrator never anticipated the huge demand the AI arms race would create for his company's cloud computing service. It has overwhelmed us, he says, and despite buying more chips, we're still behind. Over the past year, the company, headquartered in Roseland, New Jersey, has raised a total of $12 billion in a mix of debt financing and venture capital from Blackstone, Coatue, and others to try to satiate that demand, with its valuation catapulting to $19 billion. Key to CoreWeave's rapid ascent is the large number of prized NVIDIA GPUs it acquired for crypto mining back in 2017. It pivoted in 2019 to renting them out to AI startups. By 2023, its business had exploded. With more than a dozen data centers across the United States, CoreWeave is now eyeing international expansion in Spain, Norway, and Sweden, and is considering an IPO as soon as 2025. Figma, CEO Dylan Field, valuation $12.5 billion, product design and development. After seemingly graduating from this list in 2023, Figma has been reinstated after its planned acquisition of Adobe for $20 billion fell through in December due to antitrust concerns. 6 months later, in June, the company hosted a suddenly single party of sorts at Config, its annual user conference. There, 10,000 attendees watched CEO Dylan Field unveil Figma AI, which makes Figma's software more accessible to those who don't know textures from typographies. But the launch wasn't without growing pains. An accusation went viral on X that Figma's new feature for generating designs from just a prompt was borrowing from existing apps. Field disputed it, but announced he was temporarily rolling it back. "I hate missing the mark," he posted on the social site. And Anthropic, CEO Dario Amodei, valuation $18.2 billion, AI research and products. Anthropic has emerged as the OpenAI challenger with the most staying power. In June, the $18 billion valuation AI company released a large language model that co-founder and CEO Dario Amodei boasts outperforms every competitor regardless of price. The model, called Claude 3.5 Sonnet, is already hard at work coding apps and adjusting legal documents. But Amodei is most excited about healthcare. Pfizer and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute are early customers, as is DeepScribe, which uses the tool to help doctors organize conversations with patients. As the models get smarter, they're going to be increasingly used for the core of the field, according to Amodei. That concludes this week's edition of The Fortune Program. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.
Hello, and welcome to Readings from Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, read to you by Steve Malisi. Your guide to open enrollment. With healthcare costs on the rise, it's critical to select a plan that fits your needs at the right price. Get ready for one of the most important shopping periods of the year, and it has nothing to do with buying holiday gifts. As 2024 winds down, millions of Americans will choose their 2025 health insurance coverage through their employer, the Affordable Care Act Marketplace, or Medicare. While not as exciting as other seasonal shopping sprees, this period presents some of the most consequential buying decisions you will make. Most individuals get to shop only once a year unless you have a qualifying event such as getting married, having a baby, or a spouse losing their job. So take the time to understand what's offered to you, says Regina Erke, a senior director and North America Health Equity and Well-Being leader for benefits consulting firm WTW. Although the choices you make every year are important, what you select for 2025 is especially crucial, Erke says, because the accelerating pace of healthcare cost increases means you may pay more in premiums and other expenses. Start by pulling up each explanation of benefits you've received in 2024 and reviewing the healthcare services you used, says Paul Fronston, Director of Health Benefits Research at the Employee Benefit Research Institute. This should give you a baseline for what you'll need in 2025. See how many visits you had with specialists and primary care physicians. Look at what prescriptions you filed and how much they cost, he says. While you can't fully predict the expenses you'll have next year, you can make as informed a decision as possible based on what you know. Make a list of the providers and facilities you regularly use, from your acupuncturist to your teenager's allergist. Take note of who was in your plan's network and who was out of network. Also, decide which professionals and practices you want to stick with and which ones you're okay replacing. Then, think ahead to any upcoming medical procedures or treatments you might need in 2025. Do you plan to undergo a fertility treatment, a knee replacement? Will you need continuing care from a chronic condition? This information will factor in when making your selection. Understand the plans. Here's a look at some of the options that may be available to you through an employer-offered plan. Health Maintenance Organization, or HMO. With this type of plan, a primary care physician manages your care. If you need to see a specialist, you usually must obtain a referral from your primary care doctor to get coverage. HMOs typically cover care only from network providers unless you need emergency assistance. Exclusive Provider Organization, or EPO. EPOs are similar to HMOs, but don't require referrals to specialists. Preferred Provider Organization, or PPO. PPOs allow you to see both in-network and out-of-network providers, with no referral needed. However, out-of-network care costs more and often requires you to meet a separate deductible before coverage starts. Point of Service, or POS. These plans offer a combination of HMO and PPO features. They cover out-of-network care, but require referrals from primary care providers to see specialists. High Deductible Health Plan, HDHP. An HDHP offers lower premiums in exchange for a higher deductible. This plan is available with different network options, such as an HMO, EPO, PPO, or POS. Many HDHPs are paired with a health savings account, or HSA, which allows you to save pre-tax money for qualified medical expenses. Employers may contribute to your HSA as well. HSAs come with some valuable benefits. The funds in an HSA don't expire. The balance rolls over from year to year. And HSAs are triple tax advantaged. Contributions are made pre-tax. The funds grow tax-free. And withdrawals for qualified medical expenses are tax-free. You can use the funds for future expenses, such as healthcare costs in retirement. For 2025, you're eligible to contribute to an HSA if your plan has an annual deductible of at least $1,650 for individual coverage or $3,300 for family coverage. Individuals with self-only coverage can contribute up to $4,300 for 2025. Those with family coverage can contribute up to $8,550. Those who are 55 or older can contribute an additional $1,000 to their accounts. Compare costs and coverage details. Employers often cover a portion of your premium expenses. According to the Business Group on Health, in 2024, large employers contributed an average of $12,932 to each employee's premium annually, while employees paid $2,983. Still, even if you get financial assistance, coverage can be expensive, so it's important to be proactive when doing your research and considering your options. Don't wait until the last minute. You'll need time to pick a plan that's right for you. A helpful initial step is to understand how much will be withheld from your paycheck to cover premiums. Next, get a good grasp of deductibles, copayments, coinsurance, and out-of-pocket maximums. If you're considering an HDHP with an HSA, factor in any money your employer will contribute to that account when deciding what plan to go with, says Fronston. Of the 60% of employers that offer an HSA, 62% contribute to their employees' accounts, according to the Society for Human Resource Management. On average, the maximum annual employer contribution is about $1,033 for individual plans and $1,633 for family plans. Don't forget to evaluate cost information for prescription drugs, especially if you or your family members take any medications for ongoing conditions. Many employers offer online tools to simplify this comparison. You can also review the Summary of Benefits and Coverage, SBC, for each plan offered. SBCs, which plans are required to distribute, should provide key information in a clear, understandable manner. While costs are important, don't make a decision based solely on the numbers. Dig a little deeper to see whether your frequently used providers are in network. Often, you can do this by looking through an online directory on the insurer's website. Call your providers as well, as websites are not always up to date, says Fronston. If your providers are not in the plan you want, and you don't want to switch providers, you'll need to factor in the costs of going out of network. Keep in mind that you'll have to make some trade-offs, such as choosing between a low premium or low out-of-pocket expenses. Think about what you value and decide what's important, Fronston says. You don't have to navigate this process on your own. Many workplaces offer group information sessions, in-person and virtual office hours, and the ability to directly contact a human resources representative, a benefits administrator, or another educator for help. There's one more step to take if you're married or have a domestic partner who works at an employer that allows spouses and domestic partners to join its plan, or vice versa. Compare your options to your partner's plans, factoring in any potential spousal surcharges. Be aware that while most employers have open enrollment in the fall, not all sign-up periods are the same, notes WTW's Erky. If your open enrollment windows overlap, you can truly compare and contrast what you can get from two different employers, she says. If they don't, you'll have to compare using material for 2025 plans from one employer and then make some assumptions based on what was offered by the other in 2024. Capitalize on additional benefits. Besides health insurance, employers may extend other benefits that can save you money, provide helpful resources, and enhance your mental, physical, and financial health. Many employees don't take full advantage of these additional perks, often leaving money on the table, Erky says. Offerings vary by employer, but in general, here's what to look for. Supplemental insurance. Many workplaces provide discounted group rates for extra insurance, such as disability insurance, critical illness insurance, enhanced life insurance, and vision and dental care. Before enrolling, be sure to get details on what's covered, along with any exclusions and limitations. Flexible spending accounts, or FSAs. These accounts let you set aside pre-tax dollars to pay for qualifying expenses. There are three main types: healthcare FSAs for health-related expenses, dependent care FSAs for costs related to children and adults who are qualified dependents, and limited-purpose FSAs for vision and dental expenses. FSAs have restrictions and rules that can affect your contributions, so be sure to familiarize yourself with those. For instance, FSAs have a set period to use the money, or you lose it. Additionally, if you leave your job with money still in your account, you may forfeit those funds. If you have a high-deductible plan and contribute to an HSA, you can't fund an FSA for health-related expenses. Education assistance. Nearly half of employers offer graduate or undergraduate tuition assistance for employees, according to SHRM. And 10% of large employers contribute to student loan repayment, or will contribute in 2025, while 13% will provide refinancing assistance, according to benefits consultant Mercer. Free and discounted services. Employers are increasingly providing access to investment and financial planning services, which may include free consultations with advisors, as well as connections to discounted legal services for tasks such as creating wills and power of attorney documents. Other perks may include discounted pet insurance, free subscriptions to meditation apps, subsidized gym memberships, and identity theft protection services. Take advantage of workplace perks. Many employers provide a number of benefits that go beyond health insurance. Here are a variety of perks and the percentage of large employers that offer them in 2024 or plan to offer them in 2025. Financial wellness programs, such as financial coaching and investment advice, 68%. Subsidized phone or internet for remote working, 21%. Employer-provided or subsidized transportation, including commuter cards, 18%. Free or subsidized meals at work, 17%. Stipend for home office setup or supplies, 16%. Lifestyle account for being well-being activities, life needs, and hobbies, 15%. Student loan refinancing assistance, 13%. Employer-paid identity protection and password programs, 13%. Employer-paid legal services, including virtual solutions, 12%. And contributions toward student loan repayment, 10%. What to know about Affordable Care Act plans. If you purchase health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace, you'll need to familiarize yourself with the types of plans available. In most states, open enrollment for ACA plans runs from November 1st through December 15th for coverage that begins January 1st, 2025. During this period, you can enroll in, renew, or change ACA plans. All ACA plans must cover a set of core health benefits, including preventive services, maternity care, and emergency services. Your options will be categorized into four metal tiers: bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. The tiers represent the percentage of health care costs shared by the insurer and policyholder. Generally, bronze plans have the lowest premiums and highest deductibles, while platinum plans have the highest premiums and lowest deductibles. Silver and gold plans fall in between. You can review plans and prices in your state at www.healthcare.gov/c-plans. And you can find contact information for an agent, broker, or assister who is trained to help consumers apply for and enroll in a marketplace plan at www.healthcare.gov/local-help. Unlike most workers who have employer-offered health insurance, participants in ACA plans have to pay the entire premium. However, you may qualify for a government subsidy, which comes as a tax credit, based on your annual household income. Previously, these subsidies were available only to people whose income was less than 400% of the federal poverty level. But the subsidies were expanded significantly in 2021 and extended through 2025, which means people at higher income levels can qualify too. At lower income levels, you may also qualify for a cost-sharing subsidy to help cover the deductible and co-payments. Money manners for the modern age. The customs for splitting a restaurant check, purchasing a wedding gift, tipping, and more have evolved. These guidelines can help. Talking about money can be uncomfortable and awkward, but if you want to be considerate of others while staying within your budget, you should establish guidelines on matters such as dining out with friends, attending a wedding, or deciding on how much to tip. A lot of people think money is not polite conversation, but contemporary etiquette guidelines indicate the opposite. We really want money to be an approachable topic, says Lizzie Post, great-great-granddaughter of famed etiquette expert Emily Post, and co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette. Etiquette norms are cultural, and expectations are often driven by common behaviors that vary depending on where you are and who you're with. Although there is no one-size-fits-all approach to many money matters, consider these common-sense strategies when navigating social and service settings. Dining out with friends. When dining with a group, Post says, it's important to identify the difference between organizing and inviting. If you're hosting the meal, you should be prepared to pay the bill, she says. If you and your friends are organizing a meal out together, it's okay to split the bill. But talk in advance about how you'll share the costs, especially for groups in which individuals expect to order different amounts. One person may join just for a drink, for example, while others get full meals and desserts. Ask your server whether you can get separate checks so that diners can pay their own way. Bring at least enough cash to pay your portion of the bill, Post says. This may seem old-fashioned in the age of payment apps such as Venmo and Zelle, which many people use to split a restaurant bill. But it's a good idea to have cash on hand, especially if you're dining out with new friends who may not use those payment methods. Birthday dinners can create their own money dilemmas, making advance planning even more important. For example, some people assume that everyone should split the check and pay for the honoree's meal, even if the honoree issued the invites. But if you're planning to host your own birthday event, you should plan to pick up the tab for your friends. Similarly, if you're hosting a dinner party, don't ask friends to help with the costs after the fact. No one wants to receive a surprise $20 Venmo request after a simple pasta night at your house. If you want to split the costs of a dinner party, then organize a potluck dinner and ask everyone to bring a dish to share. Celebratory gifting. Gifting is a practice steeped in tradition, especially at weddings. You're not required to use the gift registry, Post says, but it can help you avoid purchasing redundant gifts, because you can usually see whether something has already been purchased for the couple. A common myth is that the wedding gift should be equal to or greater in value than the cost of your dinner plate at the reception. But hosts typically don't share information on dinner costs with their guests, and it's difficult to estimate the expense yourself. Given what you can afford to give, give what you can afford to give, even if the reception features surf and turf. If you can't afford to attend a wedding or other celebration, offer your regrets using the reply card or RSVP link provided. You don't need to provide the reason that you're not attending, Post says, but consider sending a gift or small acknowledgement to thank the host for including you in their celebration. An old-school tradition is that if you decline a wedding invitation, you should still send a gift, Post says. I would say fewer and fewer people know about that tradition these days, but we haven't changed our advice yet. Cash is acceptable as a graduation or wedding gift, and some people, particularly older couples who have all the appliances they need, welcome it. But in other situations, such as birthdays and anniversaries, try to come up with something meaningful and reflective of your relationship with the recipient, Post says. Avoid re-gifting something simply because you'd rather not keep it. And if you're planning to give a gag gift as a joke, run it by at least a few other people before you do. Sometimes, even the most well-intended jokes can land poorly. The type of birthday matters, too. Gifts aren't usually expected for adult birthdays, but you probably shouldn't show up empty-handed at a child's birthday party, unless you're asked not to bring a gift. Paying for group vacations. Whether it's a weekend with friends or an extended stay for a family get-together, shared expenses should be discussed in detail well in advance of a group trip. Otherwise, you run the risk that someone else in the group will feel obligated to cover expenses they can't afford. Consider discussing your travel style with your friends or family members. For instance, do members of the group like to shop at local markets and prepare shared meals at the vacation rental? Or do they prefer to eat out and take a break from food prep and dish duty? When it comes to lodging, do they care more about location or amenities? Do they want to split a rental car or rely on public transportation? And if you're splitting a vacation rental rather than booking rooms at a hotel, be sure to discuss whether you'll divide up the rent on a per-person or per-room basis, because the distribution of costs on a per-room basis may fall disproportionately on single people compared with couples sharing a bed. Research your destination ahead of time so you can estimate costs such as drinks, meals, entertainment, recreation, and any other activities. That way, members of the group who can't afford the trip can bow out before they sink any money into it. Likewise, if you've been invited to a group trip that's shaping up to be too costly for you, don't be afraid to speak up. It's normal for people to approach travel spending differently, and voicing your preference for a lower-cost excursion will probably resonate with more people than you think. Someone might offer to find a way to make the trip more affordable for you and other members of the group. Realistically, you're probably not going to anticipate every expense, particularly if it's an extended stay. But consider keeping a tally of who pays for what during the trip. TravelSpend is a free app that allows you to invite travel companions to enter their expenses by category. The app automatically calculates how much each person has spent, which makes it easier to share costs. Or you can simply bring a pen and notebook that everyone can use to write down expenses they cover so you can sort it out at the end of the trip. The key is to have a system of accountability in place. Tipping in service settings. There are several major motivations behind tipping, says Michael Lynn, a social scientist at Cornell University. One is to reward good service. A second is to ensure good service in the future if you continue to visit the establishment. In addition, many customers are aware that service workers, especially in restaurants, receive low wages and want to help them out. But regardless of why we tip, whether when dining out, riding in a taxi, staying at a hotel, or getting a haircut, tipping is expected in our culture. It's even baked into our laws. The minimum wage requirements for tipped servers are lower than those who don't work for tips. The appropriate amount for a tip varies depending on the service provided. You can always tip more than what is standard, but you should never forgo tipping when you get table service at a restaurant, Post says. If the service was inadequate, you should communicate that with the manager or other supervisor, not with your dollars, she says. At restaurants, the standard tip is still 15 to 20% on top of your pre-tax bill. However, it's becoming increasingly common for restaurants to add a 15 to 20% service charge to your bill. When you make a reservation at a restaurant, consider asking whether you'll see a service charge on the bill, and if so, who receives it. If you'd like to reward good service, you should leave a tip even if there is a service charge, although it's okay to tip just 10 to 15%. A standard tip for a taxi ride is typically around 10 to 20% of the total fare. However, if a taxi driver helps load and unload your luggage or other items, an additional tip of $2 to $10 is appropriate. For salon and spa services, such as haircuts, massages, facials, or other forms of pampering, the standard tip is usually between 15 and 20% of the total bill. It's customary not to tip the salon owner. If you're not sure whether your service provider accepts tips, ask them, Post says. When it comes to counter service, you do not always have to tip, even though it may feel expected when the cashier flips a touchscreen card reader around with a prompt to add a gratuity. Whether you're presented with an electronic device or a tip jar, tipping is optional, Post says. Holiday tipping. Tipping around the holidays is a traditional way to say thank you to the service providers in your life. The quality of the service you've received and your personal budget will dictate the amount you give. The amount that you pay for one appointment or session is a typical holiday tip for a dog groomer, hairstylist, regular cleaning person, personal trainer, or massage therapist. A week's pay is a suitable holiday tip for a caregiver such as a senior care aide or a regular babysitter, nanny, or au pair. If you'd like to give a tip to your child's daycare provider or teacher, check the daycare or school's policies first. Cash gifts may be prohibited. You might also consider donating to help fund a classroom project as a way to support your child's teacher. To learn more about Donors Choose, an organization that crowdfunds school projects for, see, helping teachers supply their classrooms. If you use grocery delivery or curbside pickup services, consider tipping the attendant or driver in recognition of the provider's hard work during the holiday season. For people who work as a team, such as gardeners, landscapers, or trash and recycling collectors, tip anywhere from $10 to $30. Not all professionals can accept tips. For example, postal workers may not accept cash gifts or checks, but are allowed to accept small gifts that are worth no more than $20, such as travel mugs, hand warmers, or gift cards, as long as the gift cards aren't exchangeable for cash. FedEx drivers are prohibited by work rules from accepting payments from customers. UPS drivers are not barred from taking tips, but are encouraged to decline them. For these workers, consider leaving a basket of prepackaged snacks and drinks at your door as a form of gratuity. Tax deadline. Time is running out. If Congress fails to extend the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, these provisions will expire at the end of 2025. Tax rates. The current individual income tax rates of 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, and 37% will revert to 10, 15, 25, 28, 33, 35, and 39.6%. Standard deduction and personal exemptions. The standard deduction, which was more than doubled by the 2017 law, will revert to previous amounts adjusted for inflation. Personal exemptions, which were eliminated in the TCJA, will return. Alternative minimum tax. Exemption amounts and phase-outs will expire, causing more taxpayers to pay the AMT. Estate tax exemptions. The current exemption of $13.6 million, or $27.2 million for married couples, will drop to a pre-2017 level, adjusted for inflation, or about $7.5 million, about $15 million for a married couple. Child tax credit. This credit will drop to $1,000 per qualifying child, down from $2,000, and the $500 credit for each dependent who isn't a child will disappear. State tax deduction. The $10,000 cap on deductions for state and local taxes will disappear, enabling taxpayers to deduct the entire amount of property and/or state income taxes. And this has been Readings from Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.